This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with a member of Russell Maroon Schotz's legal team, Brett Grody, about recent developments in his case. Maroon Schotz has been held in solitary confinement for over 2 decades. It's about time for a change. We'll talk with attorney Andrea Costello about a recent victory in the morning after pill. The U.S. is poised to join at least 63 other countries in making the morning after pill available without a prescription. We're approaching the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the systematic implementation of a plan to exterminate the Armenian race. We'll hear part of a documentary produced by Law and Disorder on the Armenian genocide. Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We welcome back Brett Grody, a member of Russell Maroon Schotz's legal defense team. As many listeners may recall, Russell Schotz has spent 39 years in the U.S. prison system, 21 of those under intense lockdown, spending no more than 1 hour a day outside of his cell. He was incarcerated in 1972 for his activity as a member of the Black Liberation Army. Brett brings us up to date on the case and tells us of some recent developments. Welcome, Brett, to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Heidi. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's wonderful to have you back again. There have been some developments in the case of Russell Maroon Schotz. Listeners will recall that he's been in solitary confinement for several decades, but he's been moved out of the facility where he was. Can you bring us up to date on what's happened?
Sure. On Friday, almost 2 weeks ago, I think it was March 29th, I went down to the prison with another member of the legal team and with Maroon's son, Russell Schotz III. And when we went into the visitor's lobby, we were informed that he was no longer there. So after 18 years at SCI Green, which has the largest restricted housing units, which is the control unit, solitary confinement unit, as the largest one of those in the state, he had been transferred to SCI Mahanoy, which is in the eastern central part of the state, which, as your listeners may also recall, is where Mumia Abu-Jamal is currently located in the general prison population. So he was transferred there on Thursday, March 28th, and we put in calls the next day to begin inquiring as to what was going on. He received visits on Monday after from family and members of the legal team, including myself, the following day on Tuesday. From the statements that have been made by Secretary Wetzel's office, who heads the Department of Correction, and SCI Mahanoy, there seemed to be promising signs that this move was in response. We actually know that this move was in response to the growing pressure campaign that is being waged, to the support that's coming in from around the country, and to the legal team having increasing visits and very clearly being in preparation for bringing litigation on Maroon's behalf in order to get him out of solitary confinement.
Brett, tell us a bit more about what the legal team is doing. Have they filed anything?
Right. So the legal team is Dan Kovalik, who represented Maroon in his challenge, his due process-based challenge to solitary confinement in the late 90s. There was a Third Circuit decision that came down in the year 2000. So Dan is one of the attorneys. There are also two attorneys from the large international litigation firm Reed Smith who are doing pro bono work on this case, Stephanie Lepore and Rick Etter. There's Dustin McDaniel, who, along with myself, has just formed an organization called the Abolitionist Law Center. Then there have been 5 students, including myself, who have been working on this case the last term. There was a demand letter that was sent to Secretary Wetzel's office just this Monday, on April 8th, stating that if he is not released into the general prison population within 30 days, a civil action will be filed. That demand letter can be found online on Russell Schotz's website. I believe it's russellmaroonschotz.wordpress.com, or on the Human Rights Coalition's website, hrcoalition.org. So if he is not out of solitary by May 8th, then on May 9th, a lawsuit is set to be filed.
tell us a little bit more about the solitary confinement. What constitutional issues does this raise, aside from the fact we know that being in solitary for more than a certain period of time has been deemed to be torture by the United Nations? What are the legal issues?
The major one is the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. And the law on solitary confinement, or as it's oftentimes called in the case law, segregated confinement, administrative segregation, or any of these other euphemisms, is not very good. But it's also emerging in response to the about 30-year emergence of this type of supermax-style control unit long-term lockdown as a affirmative policy of prison management. So the basic rule of law is that solitary confinement is not unconstitutional per se, but there needs to be a fact-specific inquiry into the conditions of confinement and also the degree of harm that is imposed upon the prisoner. In Eighth Amendment conditions of confinement claims, there's two requirements, an objective and a subjective element. The prison officials need to demonstrate deliberate indifference to the that's the subjective element, to the deprivation of basic human needs. That's the objective element. So because of that standard, the constitutionality of solitary confinement has oftentimes been tied to the particular vulnerabilities of prisoners. So there are decisions out of California with the Madrid v. Gomez case in 95 challenging Pelican Bay after it was first opened, which held that this type of confinement, 23, 24-hour lockdown in very sterile, austere conditions with minimal access to writing materials, no access to programming, vocational training, very limited visits, you know, no contact visits, etc., that this is unconstitutional as applies to people with serious mental illness, with developmental disabilities, or who are particularly vulnerable for psychological decompensation. There have been some other holdings out of Wisconsin court, district courts that have had come to similar conclusions, and there was just one in December in the federal court in Indiana on a big class action. Now, there are some other grounds that are being put forward to challenge solitary confinement. One of these is happening in the state of New York right now, where the New York Civil Liberties Union has begun representing an individual who was bringing a case pro se by himself, and they are challenging this Mr. Fisher, I think his name is, spending more than 3 years of solitary confinement for a nonviolent offense. So that's kind of a proportionality argument, and there's a lot of data that the Correctional Association of New York and others have uncovered about people being placed in solitary confinement for trivial infractions in New York. So that's a major aspect of that challenge, which has just been expanded to a class action very recently. And now the challenge that's most relevant to Maroon's situation is challenging solitary confinement based on the duration. And the duration of time spent in these conditions is one of the major considerations that is supposed to be taken into account by the court. And the Supreme Court has been clear on that since the late 70s, and every single circuit court has acknowledged that the duration of any particular deprivation is very significant for constitutional purposes. And the leading case on this is actually the case of the Angola 3, Wilkerson v. Stadler. It's a district court summary judgment holding from the year 2007, which stated, as a matter of course, spending more than 30 years in solitary confinement raises a sufficient claim under the Eighth Amendment to survive summary judgment based on those plaintiffs there, the Angola 3 being deprived of social interaction, environmental stimulation, and a couple of other basic human needs such as exercise and physical health due to the impact that these types of constrictive and stress-filled environments have on a person's physiological health as well. There are some other cases that are being brought forward challenging this type of long-term lockdown that focus on the duration, and the Pelican Bay class action in California, which is being brought on behalf of a class of more than 1,000 prisoners in Pelican Bay, also has a subclass of more than 500 prisoners who have been held 10 years or longer in solitary confinement, not for any disciplinary infractions, mind you, but because they are alleged to be members of so-called gangs, and so they are being locked down until they snitch or debrief, as it's called in the prison.
Your knowledge of this is masterful. Why Russell? Why is he in solitary?
Well, I'll just run through a little bit of the history, and then the analysis will flow from that. But Maroon escaped from prison twice, once in 1977 and once in 1980. After his last escape, however, he was released. He spent some time in solitary, and then he was released into the general prison population at the State Correctional Institution in Pittsburgh in 1982. At this point, Maroon had made a calculated decision that his political practice inside of the prison was going to change from trying to liberate himself by the means he had used in the past to working through approved channels and working with other prisoners according to the rules set out by prison authorities. And along those lines, he had become part of something called the Pennsylvania Association of Lifers. This was a group that was approved by the prison authorities, and there was never too much interest or too much activity going on with the organization prior to Maroon's involvement. There were five or six people that would maybe show up at meetings when Maroon started going. After Maroon became involved, and a number of other lifers there at SCI Pittsburgh were pushing this to take on a more active role in support of their interests, more than 100 people began attending the meetings there. And Maroon's purpose was always very focused on getting the people inside of the prison to connect with family, relatives, and supporters on the outside, and basically to form a lobbying group to try to get sentencing reform, to get rid of life without parole sentences in the state of Pennsylvania, which is arguably a quite moderate, you know, political position. And the prison authorities, however, reacted with the most harsh, severe crackdown on him that he had faced up until that point, and which is still ongoing to this very day. They put him in solitary confinement on the grounds that he had participated in an unauthorized meeting, even though all of their meeting spaces had to be opened by staff. And he was there for 30 days, and afterwards they continued to just hold him there. That was 1983. And he stayed in solitary at SCI Pittsburgh and then later SCI Dallas, which is in eastern PA, until 1989. In 1989, in November, he was transferred to the federal penitentiary at Leavenworth. There had been an uprising in another prison in Pennsylvania, and they kind of rounded up the people that they felt most threatened by in the system, even though Maroon had nothing to do with this uprising. He was at a different prison. They sent him to the federal joint. And for 18 months, he was in the general prison population there with no problems whatsoever. When he was returned to Pennsylvania, he was placed back in solitary confinement at SCI Dallas. And shortly after SCI Green opened up in southwestern Pennsylvania, he was transferred there. Since 1989, he has had only one disciplinary infraction while in the prison. That was for covering the vent in his cell at SCI Green to try to stay warm. It was blowing cold air. It's always blowing cold air at SCI Green year-round for the entire 18 years that he was there. So this gets to the question, why is he being locked down? During the entire time he was in solitary, whether it was at SCI Pittsburgh, Dallas, or Green, Maroon was constantly engaging all of the other prisoners in educational seminars, studying lessons on geography, lessons on history, and working with the younger people to get them to transform their criminal consciousness into a community-oriented activist consciousness. And as part of the background research that we've been doing into this case and investigations, we've talked with several people who are still in the custody of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections and with some who have since been released, who have stated things such as, Maroon saved my life. He helped me turn around this very destructive way that I was on. He helped me really understand my place in this system and what this system is doing to our communities, and, you know, inspired me to be an asset to my community. In addition to these types of his role as an educator and mentor of others within the prison system, he is also one to stand up for his rights. He's filed numerous civil actions when his rights are being violated, some pro se, some with legal representation. He's been a witness during other prisoners' civil suits, and he's encouraged people to write to the Human Rights Coalition or other outside organizations whenever there are abuses going on inside of the prison. And this totality of Maroon's persona, of his role as an educator, and as his unwavering, uncompromising commitment to human rights is all of factors in the prison authorities' fear of him. They fear the amount of respect that he generates amongst other prisoners, and they know that he will not be broken. And they want to keep him under lockdown. Now, until this pressure campaign started, they were very content to let him stay there until he died.
You visited Russell. How is he?
He recognizes that this transfer was a preemptive move to the increasing political and legal action that's being taken on his behalf. He was very encouraged by the fact that he was transferred on a Thursday. And mind you, they, of course, do not state when they are transferring a prisoner. And, you know, before a week had gone by, he had seen family members, he had seen legal team. And he's very encouraged by the campaign that was intensified on April 8th with the sending of this demand letter. And there's a 30-day kind of ongoing action alert where we are asking people to call the Department of Corrections Secretary John Wetzel and SCI Mahanoy Superintendent John Carestes and insist that Maroon be placed into general population.
Coinciding with these new developments is the publication of a book called Maroon the Implacable, Collected Writings of Russell, edited by Fred Ho and Quincy Saul. And we don't really have time to talk about that now. Teresa Schoetz will be joining us in a week or so. But the timing is quite wonderful, the book release and this development. Any thoughts on that?
Well, it wasn't exactly an accident. And a lot of the organizing that's been going on around Maroon has been inspired by his own writings that have been circulating in zine and pamphlet form for a long time. And political, legal, and I guess the literary aspect of this are, you know, all designed to bring this to a kind of perfect storm of pressure demanding justice for him. And the book is available from PM Press. You can find it online, and it's a really fantastic collection, and it's unlike any other thing that you're likely to read this year.
Brett, just a final thought and question. You're still in law school?
Like 3 more weeks, yes.
And your plans upon graduation?
Well, I'll study for the bar exam, but then I'm going to be working on behalf of the Abolitionist Law Center, which is going to be doing work on behalf of the prison abolitionist movement, and is going to be working with people primarily within the state prisons in Pennsylvania, but also looking to build political links and organizing links with other grassroots, radical, and revolutionary-minded people and organizations.
Brett, you're indeed a remarkable person, and I think that in a few years you will be arguing before the Supreme Court, and also you might consider a law professorship because you really condense complicated material and combine it in what the National Lawyers Guild calls really the best spirit of people's lawyering. And you've been so committed to this case. We're very fortunate to have you as a movement lawyer.
Well, thank you, Heidi. You're very kind. And if I ever do decide to go into academia, it seems like a long shot, right? I'm trying to get out right now, but I will definitely hit you up for a letter of recommendation.
You have it. We hope to talk to you again soon. Best of luck with all this fine work.
Thanks so much, Heidi. It was great talking to you.
After a multi-year grassroots campaign and an equally long lawsuit, the Morning After Pill will finally be available to females of all ages on the pharmacy shelf and without a prescription or point of sale or age restriction. This is thanks to a recent federal court reversal of decisions of the Federal Drug Administration and the Department of Health and Human Services under both the Bush and Obama administrations. The United States now joins at least 63 other countries, including the UK, France, Denmark, and Ghana, in making the morning after pill available without a prescription. Here to discuss the years of organizing and the recent lawsuit that resulted in this significant reversal is Andrea Costello, Senior Staff Attorney at the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Andrea.
Thank you, Heidi. It's great to be here.
Tell us exactly when the lawsuit Tumino v. Hamburg was brought and what your involvement was in the case.
The case was originally filed in 2005, and this was after the Food and Drug Administration had really stalled out and delayed for years in its decision-making about whether to put the morning-after pill over the counter. And the victory in the case is a result of over a decade of a hard-fought legal battle and really a powerful grassroots feminist campaign led by National Women's Liberation. And the decision orders the Food and Drug Administration to make the morning after pill available without a prescription and without what are called any point of sale or age restrictions within 30 days of the court's decision, which really means that it will be put out in grocery stores and bodegas and gas stations right next to the condoms.
Andrea, remind us, when the morning after pill was originally created, were there restrictions on its sales?
Well, yes. And there were originally the morning after pill was restricted by prescription only, and it was behind the counter. So anyone who needed it had to go to the pharmacy, have a prescription, and had to show identification in order to get it. At some point, after we filed the lawsuit in 2005, the government had changed its decision-making about Plan B, which was on the market at the time, in August 2006, and had agreed in response to pressure from the litigation and also the grassroots organizing campaign to make Plan B available without a prescription, but only for women who were 18 or older. So it remained behind the pharmacy counter, and anyone who needed it had to show government-issued ID. And then in 2009, while the litigation was still going on, the court issued a ruling that found that the FDA had really acted in bad faith and in response to political pressure and had departed in significant ways from its normal procedures and how it switched drugs and over-the-counter use and engaged in repeated and unreasonable delays. And the court ordered the FDA in 2009 to make Plan B available over-the-counter to women who were 17 years and older without a prescription. So at that point, it became what's called split labels. So some people could get access to it without a prescription, but it still remained behind the counter, and everyone still had to show identification.
Now, let's for a minute talk about the political pressure from both the Bush administration and the Obama administration. What were the purported reasons for needing an age restriction or a prescription for this?
Well, under President Bush, decisions were made by high-level officials within the FDA to deny access to the morning-after pill to women and girls, and that was really in an effort to appease the administration's constituents, and it was based on anti-birth control politics and not science, because the science in this case has always shown for over a decade, and the FDA's own review by its own scientific staff has always shown that there is enough scientific evidence to show that the morning after pill is safe and effective for self-medication, so anyone should be able to use it. So really, during the previous administration under Bush, we saw this overtly anti-birth control politics going on. And then under the Obama administration in 2011, really for the first time in United States history, we saw Health and Human Services under the Obama administration overruling a decision by the FDA when the FDA decided that it actually wanted to put the morning after pill over the counter fully without an age restriction. This was an unprecedented decision. The Secretary of HHS took the decision-making power away from the FDA and its scientific staff and overruled that decision. And that was done with the full support of the Obama administration. So really, years of litigation combined with grassroots feminist political organizing had finally overturned the FDA's efforts to withhold and restrict this critical form of birth control. But the Obama administration really made a political decision to continue to restrict access. And really, to us, the decision confirms that the FDA and HHS's consideration of whether to make the morning after pill over-the-counter was subject to political interference and anti-birth control politics and not science. And throughout the judge's opinion, he refers to the political interference from the White House and that the motivation for Secretary Sebelius's action was obviously political.
And DHHS, did they cite so-called scientific reasons for this?
No. The Secretary of Health and Human Services said that there were concerns about access to the pills by 11-year-olds, and that was what she cited. And the Secretary of HHS is also not a scientist, and she doesn't have any scientific qualifications.
Well, let me ask you this. Did you alter the nature of the lawsuit as things progressed in this political fashion?
No. The lawsuit has always asked for unrestricted access to the morning after pill and all forms of the morning after pill, meaning emergency contraception, for all women and girls in the United States, regardless of age, without any restriction as to how it's sold. And that's really because the scientific evidence has always been there.
And in fact, over 60 countries around the globe make the morning after pill available without a prescription.
That's true.
In the context of other restrictions on women's reproductive rights, how does this fit into the big picture?
Well, I think this case really shows the power of grassroots movements for social change. And really, in the struggle for reproductive justice, we have not had a victory in decades. I mean, we've been in a very defensive posture for a very long time. And so in the history of our country, no one has ever had to show identification in order to get their birth control. And so this decision really, I think, validates that women and girls should have access to safe and effective forms of birth control, and that the ability to control our reproduction for women and girls is really a fundamental part of women's self-determination and the ability to control the direction of our lives.
Can you tell us a bit about Annie Tumino and what the facts were in this case?
Annie Tumino is a mom, and she's a mom of a newborn. She was not at the time that this case was filed, but she, like the other plaintiffs who are members of National Women's Liberation, filed this case on behalf of themselves and women who need access to the morning after pill. And she, like the other members of National Women's Liberation, feel very strongly and are committed to women's reproductive rights and to having access to the morning after pill and all forms of birth control as a means of women being able to control their reproduction.
Andrea, we're very proud that you're a member of the National Lawyers Guild and have been for many years. And really, you join an esteemed group of other women who over the years have fought for and secured landmark victories for the rights of girls and women. Can you name some of your mentors?
Sure. You know, a couple people that stood out to me, and I think about, you know, this victory as building on really the pioneering work of some of our feminist sisters in the National Lawyers Guild that I've had the opportunity to work with and really the honor to work with, like movement lawyer Catherine Rohrabach, who I met and worked with as part of some national convention work and other reproductive justice work in the Guild. And I don't know if folks know, but Catherine was the attorney who represented the plaintiff in Griswold versus Connecticut, which was decided by the Supreme Court in 1965 and established the right to privacy, which, you know, for married people to in contraception, and really discussed that the constitutionally protected right of whether or not to have a child and access to birth control being essential to being able to have and exercise that right. And I also think of women like Rhonda Copeland, who I also had the opportunity to work with, who was one of the pioneers, really, in the early struggle for abortion rights in this country, who litigated the Abramowitz versus Lefkowitz case, which legalized, along with the radical feminist movement and the women's liberation movement that was going on in New York at the time.
How can people find out more about your work and also the work of the women's coalitions that helped bring about this important decision?
Well, I know that, you know, many of us who do this work know that we need a strong grassroots movement fighting for women's freedom to not just get wins like this, but to continue to hold on to them and to break new ground. So we want to encourage people to go to our website for the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, which is justiceonline.org, to learn more about this case and the campaign, and also to learn more about the work of National Women's Liberation. You can also go to womensliberation.org.
An 11-year-old girl, if all goes well, in a few months will be able to go into a grocery store or a pharmacy and purchase Plan B without showing ID and without having to go through any other hoops.
Yes, and we think that is a great reproductive justice victory for women and girls.
Andrea Costello, it is truly an honor to have you on Law and Disorder and to celebrate this really tremendous landmark victory. You've worked on it for years. I know you've moved around during the process, but you've stayed on this case, and we thank you for that.
Thank you so much, Heidi. It's so great to do this work on behalf of the movement. It's really an honor.
Thanks, and we look forward to having you back on Law and Disorder again. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. This month marks the 99th anniversary of the beginning of the systematic implementation of a plan to exterminate the Armenian race. Carried out at the hands of the Young Turk government of the Ottoman Empire, more than half of the Armenians living in the empire were slaughtered. To commemorate this, the first genocide of the 20th century, Law and Disorder producer Jeff Brady and I, Heidi Boghossian, present a program titled It Was Genocide, Armenian Survivor Stories. We wish to thank WBAI for their commitment to recognizing the Armenian genocide and are grateful to the following individuals for opening their hearts and sharing the difficult memories of the past: Jenny Garabedian, Harry Mazadorian, Roxy Garabedian, Lucy Simonian, Roxy Maljanian, Mary Abrahamian, John Maljanian, Agnes Karanian, Ruth Swisher, and Artie Shaverdian. We go now to hear part of that documentary. Let's have a listen. Around the world, April 24th marks the observance of the Armenian Genocide. On that day in 1915, the Interior Minister of the Ottoman Empire ordered the arrest and hangings of Armenian intellectuals and community leaders in Constantinople. The date is widely considered to be the original beginning of a systematic and well-documented plan to eliminate the Armenians, who had been under Ottoman rule and treated as second-class citizens since the 15th century. The unspeakable and gruesome nature of the killings, beheadings of groups of babies, dismemberments, mass burnings, mass drownings, use of toxic gas, lethal injections, render oral histories particularly difficult. Why did this happen? Despite being deemed inferior to Turkish Muslims, the Armenian community had attained a prestigious position in the Ottoman Empire, and the central authorities there grew apprehensive of their power and their longing for a homeland. A concerted plan of deportation and extermination was allowed to be carried out, in large part, because World War I demanded the involvement and concern of potential allied countries. As the writer Grigoris Balakian wrote, the war provided the Turkish government, quote, their sole opportunity, one unprecedented, to exploit the chaos of war in order to effect their extermination plan. As Armenians escaped to several countries, including the United States, a number came to New Britain, Connecticut in 1892 to work in the factories of what was then known as the hardware capital of the world. By 1940, nearly 3,000 Armenians lived there in a tight-knit community.
"95 years has gone by, and they still have not acknowledged that this happened. And it was a genocide.
As a nation, how can they deny this? I mean, how can it be denied? It's a half of a population was removed.
I don't like Turks per se because of what they did to our people, but I do enjoy the culture.
Why would I grow up hating the Turks if she didn't tell us stories? Well, then we must have been told something that we hated the Turks.
Armenians had a lot of power, a lot of control. They were the merchants. They were people who, in essence, were major drivers of the economy and the world in Turkey.
Yeah, I think they were threatened by the culture. And the genocide started 1915, April 24, in Istanbul, where they took all the intelligentsia of the country and took them outside of the city and hanged them.
The overlay was, of course, religious, with Muslims, and they're the first country to acknowledge Christianity as a national religion. So, you know, there's a lot of history here with all of that.
The other thing that the Turks used to say, where is your Jesus now? Where is he? Why isn't he saving you? Well, they would say this on the death marches.
My brother Ernest was killed in an automobile accident. And his uncle came over to my house and said, "Hey, Ostian, where is your God now?" And she cupped her ears and she said, "Chilasim, Chilasim, I don't want to hear that. God gave him to me and God took him away." How much more Christian could you be?
As you will hear from the stories of first-generation Armenian survivors who continue to live in New Britain, Connecticut, a shared history, a shared identity emerges. Some learned about the massacres directly from their parents or family members, while others were not told at all. Often, surviving women were ashamed to talk about what they had experienced, because so many of them had been raped or forced into harems. For others, conjuring up visual images of the atrocities was too painful to bear. When parents did speak about the crimes they experienced or witnessed, they frequently spoke in Turkish or Assyrian instead of English or Armenian, so that their children couldn't understand. Most children of survivors say that the subject was a secret, even forbidden.
My mother did not keep secrets from us. She spoke about the Turks. She hated the Turks. She made us hate the Turks. I remember as a teenager, I wanted to send away for Turhan Bey's picture in Hollywood, and he was a very handsome Turkish actor. We weren't allowed anyway. But the ones who did keep it secret were the ones who were ashamed of what happened. And I know for a fact many of the older women, older than my mother, had gotten raped. Those are the ones, in my opinion, in this area, were the ones who kept it secret.
I grew up hearing, like the others, my mother didn't talk about it to me, ever. But I was a little girl, and my mother was quite a bit older than I was. She was older when I was born. And so her friends would come over, and they would sit and talk to each other. The next thing you know, they'd all start crying. And I would cry, too. And my mother would turn to me and say, "Why are you crying?" And I'd say, "Because you're crying," and not knowing why I was crying.
And just recently, we found out that this one got raped, that one got raped, and this is why they couldn't talk about it. Now, I don't know about the men, why the men kept it secret, but as far as the women, Yes, you're right. The men were too young. But many of the women did get raped, and those are the ones, in my opinion, that really kept it a secret. And my mother told me many stories, so she wasn't ashamed. She didn't have that feeling of being ashamed.
In our house, it was a secret. And then you hear someone would be talking about something, and then as you approach, they say, Biji Oğlan, which means little boy, that's me. And everything would switch into Turkish, and everybody. And then, you know, some Armenians would come visit from Whitensville, and they'd sit in the living room. They're all talking Turkish. It was a forbidden thing to discuss.
I had heard these stories as I listened. I really heard these stories. And then the old country. They always talked about the old country. And I had no idea where it was. When I was a little girl, I thought the old country was like Talland, Connecticut. And I just had no idea. But I always wanted to go there. And then I felt terrible because I never had a grandmother or a grandfather or an aunt, a real aunt or an uncle.
As children growing up, you know, friends would come to the house. Now, they would always speak Armenian, but whenever they had an off-color story to tell, and you could always tell it was an off-color story because the way they broke into laughter, it was always told in Turkish or Assyrian. And then they'd revert back to English. So the stories were really not designed for children to hear. It was for them. But you could always tell by their laughter that something was going on, you know, that they didn't want us to know about. And in point of fact, that's what they always did. If there was something going on at the dinner table, and they didn't want us to know what was going on, they'd speak Assyrian or Turkish to one another. So that whole business of speaking Turkish and the residual effects of the genocide were interesting, kind of almost juxtaposed one against the other.
Genocide has both physical and non-physical aspects, destroying the national culture of the oppressed group and imposing that of the oppressor. That was the theory of legal scholar Raphael Lemkin, who coined the word genocide in 1943 with the Turkish extermination of the Armenians in mind. While genocide is defined as the organized destruction, in whole or in part, of a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group, Lemkin wrote that a group need not be only physically exterminated to suffer genocide. Erasing a people's cultural identity through destruction of their language, religion, social, and political institutions, that too is genocide. The Armenian genocide, the very first of the 20th century, may be viewed in four distinct segments. The first segment began with the deportation and killing of the 250 intellectuals. Before that, in 1895, Ottoman suspicion of the Armenian population had led to the massacre of 300,000 Armenians by a special order of the government. In 1909, 30,000 more were slaughtered. The second segment involved the conscription of approximately 60,000 Armenian men into the General Turkish Army. They were later disarmed and killed by their Turkish counterparts. The third segment comprised of massacres, deportations, and death marches of women, children, and the elderly into the Syrian deserts. Hundreds of thousands were killed by Turkish soldiers, gendarme, and Kurdish mobs. Others perished from famine, epidemic diseases, and exposure to the elements. Thousands of women and children were raped. Tens of thousands were forcibly converted to Islam. The final segment of the genocide is still ongoing and consists of the denial by the Turkish and United States governments that a genocide even occurred. Despite the body of documentation that exists, Turkey has launched a well-orchestrated and financed campaign of denial through inaccurate scholarship, propaganda, and extensive lobbying. Turkey even has a law which forbids mention of the word genocide.
Article 301 in Turkey essentially makes genocide an illegal word to use, a term. It's a denial. If you don't have the word, it doesn't exist. Genocide didn't exist. And so what you're doing is, in essence, is saying, if we don't recognize the word, if we don't use the word, then all mention, all concept of a genocide disappears. So what can you call it? Massacres? The first Holocaust? I mean, there are a lot of ways you can define it. they've chosen because it's genocide. And it truly was genocide. The issues are deep-seated. The conflicts were deep-seated. It's not only religious. It was control. It was economic. It was financial. Armenians had a lot of power, a lot of control. They were the merchants. They were people who, in essence, were major drivers of the economy and the world in Turkey.
Arthur Shevardian's father was orphaned and came to New Britain from what is today Iran, but that was in 1915 a part of the Ottoman Empire. Arthur teaches a component on the Armenian genocide for a local high school's course on the subject of genocide.
My father is Asho Dmitri Shavardian, and that's the Armenian pronunciation, Shavardian, and my mother, Rose. The material for this particular conversation began several years ago at the request of a teacher at Avon High School who has a course called Genocide, Holocaust and Genocide. And he asked if I could come and share my family's story of the genocide with the students at Avon High School. They're juniors and seniors. It really forced me to go back and do some reconstruction. We had bits and pieces, but had never really put the story together in any format. So I went back and found some documentation that my father had kept. I did some research, historical research as well. A lot of what we have is factual information because I have the original documentation. Some of it is put together from hearsay and then trying to create a story. And in those pieces that we don't know that I've created, I hope 2 + 2 becomes 4 and not 5. But it's close. It's close to the story. And the story begins, my father was born in 1903. He always said he was born in 1905, but when we look through the original documentation, it turns out he was baptized in 1903, so therefore he couldn't have been born in 1905. Likely it had to do with presenting himself as a younger person to be able to latch on to another member of the family to come to the United States as part of the visa process.
As a second-generation Armenian, I too have pieced together the fragments of stories from my family. My grandfather was a medical student at a college in Carpet. He said he had to beg his older sister for the tuition, and when he walked down the street, people would point to him with awe as the person who was going to college. When the genocide started, he enlisted or was drafted into the army. He narrowly and with difficulty escaped and came to the United States. I don't know how, but he was proud of the fact that he didn't have to disguise himself as a woman, as other men did, in order to beg or borrow his way out of the country. Then, in 1918, when Armenia was granted independence, he went back. He said the persecutions not only still existed, but that they were worse than before, so the process of escaping was even more difficult the second time. Coming to this country with no language or professional skills, he got a job in the foundry. In a short time, a flying piece of hot metal burned out one eye. The genocide ruined his life in Armenia and also in the United States. He had sent to the orphanage in Greece for a wife. The Armenian Relief Society paid for sending my grandmother to the United States. But when she got to Ellis Island, they wouldn't let her off the ship because of a gray halo around the iris of one eye. Again, the Relief Society paid to send her to Cuba because entry from there was less stringent. They found her a family to stay with, 9 people in a one-room house with a dirt floor. They took her daily to a clinic for a nurse to put eye drops in her eye. After 6 months, the nurse told the doctor that there was no change, so she must not have had an active, dangerous condition. The doctor agreed. Now it was better for her to enter through Mexico. Her daughter, my aunt, helped tell this story and says how impressed she always was with the kindness of strangers throughout the process. Historic Armenia was located along the Mediterranean Sea, in what exists today as Turkey. It's also, according to the Book of Genesis, where Noah's Ark came to rest, the first nation to adopt Christianity in AD 301. Armenians lived for centuries in their own kingdoms until the Ottoman invasions in the 1200s, when they became second-class citizens. After World War I, the Independent Republic of Armenia existed for just 2 years, from 1918 to 1920, in a fragment of what had once been their homeland. While Armenians had been attacked often prior to the massacre of 1895, the later 1915 genocide had the specific goal of eradicating all traces of the ancient nation. With the outbreak of World War I, the Young Turk government wanted to save what remained of the weakened Ottoman Empire. It adopted a policy of pan-Turkism, the establishment of a vast Turkish empire comprised of all Turkish-speaking peoples of the Caucasus and Central Asia extending to China. The goal included the Turkification of all ethnic minorities of the empire. The Armenian population became the main obstacle toward realization of this policy. Although the decision to deport all Armenians from eastern Turkey had been adopted in late 1911, the Young Turks intentionally used World War I as a pretext for its implementation. Of the 3 million Armenians living in Turkey at that time, more than 1.5 million endured unimaginable atrocities, were slaughtered, raped, or forced into Muslim harems. Churches, which formed the religious and cultural backbone of their lives, were destroyed, while homes were burned, property confiscated, and families killed and separated forever. Lucy and Roxy, Araxi, Maljanian, and Mary Abrahamian are sisters. Together they recount their mother's story.
My name is Roxy Yesyan Maljanian. My mother came from the village of Ichme in Harput, Armenia, Turkey now, and I'm one of three sisters that are here present representing our family. And the family name was Pilibozhin. Kuyumjan was the deep name. And our mother was born in 1908. And she came here to America after the genocide. And as a little girl, she remembers quite a few things about 1915. And when my mother was in her late 60s, early 70s, she started writing her history in Armenian. And she wrote it in very colloquial Armenian. She was an Armenian school teacher here in New Britain, taught students after she got married and came here. And in her story, since it was in Armenian, my sisters and I translated it after her death. She wrote it in the last years of her life. And she remembered many things of her childhood. And we divided the story into three sections. And each sister took a third of it to translate it the best we can. We all read Armenian. Like I said, she did it simply so we can understand it. We knew some of the stories. She talked about them, her childhood in the orphanage. And she tell us the nice things, really, about the orphanage. As children, she was 7 years old until she was 18. She was in the orphanage. She remembers the groups of children who were all just like her. They had lots of fun because they were children. And they played games and sports. And they learned crafts in the orphanage. The German Protestant orphanage taught them crafts, handiwork. So they learned many things, reading and writing. So they were happy as much as possible because everybody was in the same situation. And she remained there until 18. And at 18, there were newspapers here in America looking for orphans in different orphanages. And if your name appeared on a list, the orphan director would send a letter to the person in America that we have this child in this orphanage. And they would write to the orphan, and the orphan would identify herself or himself. And in that way, they were able to get to America through a relative that was here. That's one way that people got it home. But at 18, you had to leave the orphanage. When she was 7, 1908 to 1915, she was 7 years old. Before she got to the orphanage, She remembers as a little girl, the Turkish people in the villages were all their neighbors, and they got along very good with their neighbors, and they had fun with them because they were all in the same community. Even though the majority in this village was Armenian, they had Turkish people living there too. The trouble started, the rumors start coming into the villages that things were happening, and their children. She was warned that if something happened, you know, you go with your aunts and uncles. Her mother had died when she was a child, and she was living with aunts in the village. And her father was already in America, so they lived with the aunts. The first one of the incidents she writes and talked about was she remembered the gathering of the men in the village, and the village of Ichimad, the houses were low roof, and you can go on your roof and look at what's happening. And the church was right below the street that they lived on. And my sisters and I both, all three of us, have visited Ichimad. And we took two trips to Ichimad so we can kind of visualize what happened. The church was on the street below, and they remember the men being gathered and taken into that church and hollering, and they heard the screams. And the next thing, the church was being burned, and they remember the church being burned and screaming and the hollering of all the people dying in this building. And then she recalled going from house to house, they were starting to hide from things. And you can run on the rooftops in Ichimad. They were flat roofs, close to each other. And you could jump, and you're 7, 8 years old. You jump from building to building. And they were able to jump to the next building and hide in the neighbor's house. So now they knew there was trouble. So you could go down to the next house and hide somehow. She remembered that, and then when the time came and they were coming into the village and they'd see more, maybe my sister Lucy can relate that part of the village. Do you remember them, the hiding, what the uncle told them to do?
When they came into the homes, they all had to gather whatever belongings they had to start the march. They told my mother, "We're going to hide our gold. It's going to be in this chest and come in the back, and we're going to hide it in the ground, but you never, ever tell anybody where it is." So all their gold coins and jewelry, they hid in the backyard, courtyard, wherever it was, and then they gathered them up and they started this horrific march.
The Armenian identity is now a collective one, pieced together from historical documents and personal stories handed down from survivors to their children. The media did cover the events as they happened, and the U.S. ambassador to Turkey, Henry Morgenthau, told the Secretary of State in July 1915 that, quote, "a campaign of race extermination is in progress, under a pretext of reprisal against rebellion." On May 6, 1915, the New York Times reported that, quote, "the young Turks have adopted the policy of Sultan Abdulhamid, namely, the annihilation of the Armenians." That was an excerpt from the 90-minute special, "It Was Genocide, Armenian Survivor Stories."
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.